Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Economics for Rebels, the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Not too long ago, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered. This rebellion continues. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations. Conversations with and for those who are ready to act on rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovesh, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. The common argument in favor of capitalism is that the world has seen unprecedented rise in living standard in the last 200 years. No more dangerous jobs, better access to education and health services, significant drops in the prices of basic provision, higher life expectancy, less famine. So can we also argue that all this is worth it, even at the expense of environmental degradation? Donut economics is about finding the right balance, the safe and just space where human societies can operate on local and global levels. Today's guest, Andrew Fanning, with his co-researchers, has studied how nations are doing in striking this balance. Andrew is currently data analysis and research lead at the Donut Economics Action Lab and a visiting research fellow in the Sustainability Research Institute of the University of Leeds. His area of expertise include indicators of sustainability and well-being, links between resource use and social performance, donut economics, steady state economy, and degrowth. His latest research builds on examining the historical dynamics of 11 social indicators and 6 biophysical indicators across more than 140 countries from 1992 to 2015 to see how they are doing in meeting basic needs within ecological limits. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Let us begin with the basics. While talking about the concept of donut economics would take up a whole episode, and we will certainly devote time to it in Economics for Rebels, can you shortly introduce us to donut economics?
Shortly. Yes, that's definitely good. That could definitely be a whole episode.
That's
but yeah, sure.
Podcasts.
Yes, I'll be happy to come back with my donut economics hat on the next time around. But yeah, sure. The donut was created by Kate Raworth. It's at the core concept at the heart of donut economics. So you can think of the donut as like a compass for human prosperity in the 21st century that points towards the goal of meeting the needs of all within the means of the living planet. So a goal that very much resonates in ecological economics. And really what it is, the donut is a concise visual and powerful visual framework that consists of two concentric rings. The one is a social foundation to ensure that no one is left falling short on life's essentials, and an ecological ceiling, which ensures that humanity does not collectively overshoot the planetary boundaries that protect Earth's life-supporting systems. And between these two sets of boundaries lies a donut-shaped space, where the name comes from, that is both ecologically safe and socially just, which is a space, you know, that we want that humanity can thrive. So if the 21st century goal is to meet the needs of all people within the means of the living planet, or to get into the donut, then how can humanity get there, right? So that's really at the core of donut economics and ecological economics. And I will add that I'm proud to call myself an ecological economist. I don't see any contradictions between the big ideas of ecological economics, donut economics, degrowth, post-growth, all of that stuff. I relate to all of it. So the whole idea is that last century's economic thinking, you know, it's not going to get there in terms of dealing with these challenges. So donut economics is fleshed out in Kate's best-selling book by the same name. And overall, it aims to provide like an economic mindset that's fit for the 21st century context and challenges. So it's not a set of policies or institutions, but tries to pull out, you know, a way of thinking that brings about what we refer to as regenerative and distributive dynamics that this century calls for. So Kate draws on insights, much like an ecological economist. I, I'm, I haven't actually asked her whether she would call herself an ecological economist, but really she takes it the very interdisciplinary perspective around pulling in threads from ecological thinking, feminist thinking, institutional thinking, behavioral complexity economics, and sets out these seven ways to think like a 21st century economist in order to bring the world's economy into this safe and just space. And just super briefly to touch on them, the starting point is to change the goal from endless GDP growth to thriving in the donut. And at the same time, we want to begin economic analysis by seeing the big picture, right? And recognize that the economy is embedded within and dependent upon society and the living world. Donut economics also recognizes, of course, that human behavior can be nurtured to be cooperative and caring, just as it can be competitive and individualistic. It also recognizes that economies, societies, and the rest of the living world, you know, everything, we're operating in a complex interdependent systems that they're really best understood through the lenses of systems thinking. And it calls for today's degenerative economies to transform into regenerative ones and divisive economies that concentrate wealth and value in the hands of a few into far more distributive ones. And finally, lastly, donut economics, it recognizes that growth is, it's a healthy phase of life that we observe everywhere, but nothing grows forever. And things that succeed in life do so by growing until it's time to grow up. And at that point, you know, then we get to thrive, or we get to, you know, reach our full potential only once we've been able to grow up. And yeah, that's how I'd say it.
Let's have a look at what kind of indicators we can include in such donuts. And also, in the introduction, I mentioned that a lot of emphasis has been placed on capitalism's achievements in improving social indicators. And in your research, you have looked at 11 of such indicators. What were they? And are we generally better off in them? What's your take on it?
Yeah, so Dan O'Neill, Jason Hickel, Nicholas Rue, and I have just published a new study in the Journal of Nature Sustainability that tracks nations' progress in terms of both meeting basic needs and respecting environmental limits in, you know, more than 140 countries, as you mentioned. And we also have projections to 2050 based on recent trends. And this study builds on a previous analysis for a single year that was led by Dan together with Will Lamb and Julia Steinberger. And the 11 social indicators that we looked at included a set of 9 so-called need satisfiers like nutrition or sanitation, access to energy, democratic quality, and others, and 2 overarching like indicators of well-being, which were life satisfaction and life expectancy, which are meant to capture, you know, not just one particular domain, but an overall picture of how people are doing in terms of happiness and their health. And for each indicator, we defined a defensible minimum social threshold of performance, which is not, you know, not a luxurious level of life, but a decent minimum, like 6.5 out of 10 on the happiness scale, or 74 years of life, and so on. And we examined country trajectories since the early 1990s and found that most countries are closer to providing basic needs for their residents than they were 30 years ago. So check, capitalism's narrative works there, especially for life expectancy and educational enrollment. And that's good news. I mean, although important shortfalls do remain for quite a few countries who are falling far short, as well as almost universally, not much progress, if not a decline, on more collective need satisfiers like equality and democratic quality that we've seen over the past 30 years.
Okay, so the results are, you know, I had a look at your paper and they may not be picture perfect, but many countries see some improvement, and I think that's something to celebrate. However, this comes at a cost, and this is the cost that I referred to in the introduction, that these environmental costs that ecological economists have long warned about, and also a lot of other scientists have warned about, these costs in the long run may actually jeopardize everything that we have achieved so far. And as you said, we might have reached the time when we should grow up rather than grow more. How do countries fare in this in these ecological perspectives?
Yeah, so the study distributed six planetary boundaries among nations according to their share of global population, then compared these boundaries to national resource consumption, so biophysical indicators. And just to clarify, the boundaries themselves include environmental priorities such as, you know, climate change, excessive fertilizer use, land system change, and others, which collectively form, we argue, this ecological ceiling that's intended to avoid climate and ecological breakdown. And I mean, which, yeah, just again, to note, as ecological economists have been warning for decades, I mean, Kenneth Boulding's piece on Spaceship Earth was written, what was it, more than half a century ago. So this is the biophysical story is, it's well known. And the bad news is that we find is that the number of countries that are over-consuming resources is increasing. It's unambiguous across all the indicators that we looked at, especially for carbon dioxide and material use. But that being said, when we talk about costs, the study itself, we didn't really, you know, we weren't looking directly at, I guess we're not able to say when you look at a country level, what, I guess empirically, we're looking at a performance socially. How are you doing in terms of education or health? And do you achieve this threshold? And then we look at economy-wide, what is the level of resource use you're using? But what our study doesn't do is really say, are these resources going directly to meeting basic needs? And I mean, I think that there's of course other research that does look at that. And the answer to that question is a big no in the current system, right? That a lot of our resource use is not going towards meeting basic needs. So although it's a pessimistic story to see resource use just so massively unsustainable and getting worse over time, that doesn't directly translate to meeting basic needs or say anything at all. What it's saying is that we're using more resources. What those resources are you being used towards is, of course, you know, when you look at capitalist dynamics, it's elite consumption. It's concentrating wealth in the hands of a very few. It's all of that stuff. So I think that's an important point to note when we talk about the cost of these, you know, the balance between these two indicators. They're not directly, you know, cost and benefit comparable.
Especially that, correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I can remember, equality is actually something that we're beginning to be worse and worse off.
Yeah, that's really, and I mean, this also comes out of the long history and research around capitalist dynamics, is that you can almost think of the social indicators that we looked at. I think of them more, there's some that are very clearly individual and subsistence, like nutrition or levels of access to energy or sanitation. But there are others that I think of that are more collective in nature, like equality, right? You can't have equality individually. It's a societal phenomenon. Same with democratic quality, same with social support. And what we really see in our results is that an improvement in terms of the more individualistic social indicators and a stagnation or even a decline for the more collective ones. And I think that really fits in line with the general neoliberal mindset, right, that gives excessive focus on the individual.
Even if we put this aside for a moment and say, okay, you did not look at whether they actually translate into the social indicators, you're still saying your overall conclusion is that current trends will only deepen the ecological crisis while failing to eliminate social shortfalls. So basically, what may have been true in the past, what some claim about capitalism, no longer holds true. And even if we weren't ecological economists who believe that humanity should not expand beyond the carrying capacity of the earth, and we should start reconsidering this claim of capitalism that it's worth maintaining growth, it's worth maintaining the impetus as social indicators will improve and you know, wealth will trickle down at some point in the future. Am I right in saying that we are past the point where being better off is kind of coupled to ecological problems? So basically, we're always saying that we want to decouple our growth from ecological problems. But what we have managed to do is we have decoupled ecological burdens from social goods or being better off. So is it possible that we really have decoupled these two things already?
You mean like decoupling well-being from resource?
Yes.
Like that increasing levels of resource use are not bringing any gains in terms of well-being. Definitely. I definitely agree with that. And that empirically, that comes out time and time again. You can take pretty much any biophysical indicator and any social indicator. And as resource use increases, and like looking across countries or across, you know, groups within countries, where it just shows up time and time again, that it's a curve of diminishing returns. It's logarithmic. What you really see is at low levels of resource use, you get a big increase in terms of social performance. Let's say it's CO2 emissions and life expectancy. So that because our economy is so wedded to it's fossil fuel dependent, we, in order to have a basic level of providing basic goods and services, we are emitting some CO2 emissions. And what we see is at very low levels, when you increase those CO2 emissions, it's clear that people's well-being improves because they're getting access to things that they need. But beyond a certain point, an inflection point, a tipping point, that relationship just uncouples completely. And that's what we see in wealthy countries. It's just all over the place. Like you can have a nation like the United States with, or Canada, where I'm from, with like CO2 emissions per capita, 16 tons or 18 tons or 20 tons. And life expectancy, we're living similar to or less than than the people in Spain, for example. So I think in Canada, it's 81 years life expectancy now, whereas in Spain, it's 83. And the in the level of emissions and income in Spain are like a third the size on a per capita basis. So definitely, I think that has clearly become uncoupled. And there's a great quote from Peter Victor, who, I have to paraphrase it because I don't remember it right now, but it's basically just like that looking at this data, Americans have been more successfully decoupling income from happiness than they have been decoupling it from ecological impact.
So we will not be better off even if we continue to overshoot. I guess that's the message.
Yeah. And that's a really, really important point to note too, is when we're looking ahead, in terms of this study, we do some projections to 2050, but it's super important to say that it's an empirical study that's based on current trends. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that past trends will continue into the future, or if that's even possible, given, you know, the risk of these looming tipping points in the Earth system. Like we are overshooting multiple planetary boundaries, and the idea that that could continue on a business as usual type of trajectory is highly questionable. So we have these social projections which are based on current trends, and we do see that most of these social indicators do continue to improve, with those caveats that I mentioned for most countries. Although, as we've already discussed, there are those, you know, we also see the continuing decline in the more collective social indicators, even based on the current trend. So that's almost like a separate question or a separate problem. But these social projections based on current trends should be seen as really as optimistic, if anything at all, because each social indicator is projected individually. So they don't at all take into account this simultaneous projected worsening of all ecological indicators. So I mean, the IPCC is super clear that potential social disruption from the negative impacts of climate and ecological breakdown, you know, that could be increased morbidity and health outcomes, problematic health outcomes, mortality, migration due to extreme climate events or shifts in the geographical distribution or range or, you know, transmission, what we're seeing with the pandemic of diseases, increased poverty, of course, too, because we've seen time and again that climate change is almost, it affects disproportionately those who are in the poorest and most vulnerable situations. So that's a thing when it comes to thinking ahead, you know, forward-looking approach. But on the other hand, more optimistically, I would see, is that our projections being based on the current economic system, we all know that needs transformation to have a hope of, you know, of living within the donut. So the projections are assuming current provisioning systems, and those do not at all take into account the types of radical policies and transformations that have been suggested for decades by ecological economists.
I wonder, especially after Glasgow, I think it's an interesting question. Like, could you actually see some countries where you think more ecological, more use, more resource use would still lead to better social conditions? This is always a debate when it comes even like to concepts of degrowth. Like, okay, you can only foresee degrowth in countries that are already overconsuming. And your research substantiates that claim. But what I'm wondering is could you actually see countries where you think that they could still go on like using planet's resources in order to improve their social conditions?
Definitely. Well, I believe so. I think it's worth distinguishing between very high income wealthy nations in the global north, if you want to call it that, you know, North America, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, that group of countries, and the rest of the world, almost, where you can also distinguish almost between low income and middle income or emerging economies as well. But the big distinction I would draw for the degrowth question is between the global north and the global south, so to speak, where in the global north, it's very clear that the level of resource use, again, going back to those curves that I mentioned, the level of resource use associated with virtually any indicator of social well-being has decoupled, that which, you know, opens up a possibility that we could substantially reduce resource use with minimal impact on our well-being, because it looks like we're just using a bunch of resources for, I wouldn't say for no reason, because I think there is a reason in terms of making a whole lot of people a lot richer, but in terms of meeting people's essential needs and our everyday experience, it's not, it doesn't seem to be giving us much. Well, at the same time, it's making looking like life's going to be pretty tough for, as I just mentioned, like poorer and more vulnerable people today, as well as, you know, future generations and all that. So wealthy countries, much more of a question on whether resource use can improve our well-being. I don't think that it's needed. I think that we can focus on universalizing access to basic goods and services as we see in many of the most progressive nations, but do so in such a way that is, you know, dramatically reducing resource use. So implementing policies around, I mean, within the current system, be like maximum resource caps or, just different policies like that. Then again, when it comes to global South countries, especially the world's poorest nations, our research really shows that most of them are still within fair shares of their planetary boundaries. But what is needed in those countries is to dramatically increase, accelerate improvements in people's living standards, because they're falling far short in terms of those reasonably defensible minimum social thresholds that I was talking about earlier. So I think that there is space to grow their economies. It's like I said about what donut economics realizes as the final point, right? Like, you can grow up to a point where you're now at, I think of it like a body, you're now at the size that you need to be in order to then you can dedicate the non-material resources to flourishing, to leading meaningful lives. But you do need that minimum standard, of course.
I guess it's also a question of perception. Like, being a Hungarian, obviously I was curious to see what your results were in terms of my country. And what I found interesting was that basically you said we are better off in quite a few social indicators. And I think that would probably surprise most Hungarians, because I'm not sure that's their perception of development. Mm. Because basically, where would most of us want to be? Well, on the level of Austrians, they are close enough. We know how they fare in these things, So our improvements are not seen as improvements, because we see the gap never closing. So this is this is the perception. And on the other hand, you're quite rightly saying, and of course I knew about that, but I don't think many of my fellow citizens would know that we have already overshot by miles our fair share of resource use. So it would be interesting to see country by country how the perception relates to your findings. Do you think there's any chance of doing that or using your research for such purposes?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's great. There's a couple of points there. The first one on the last question. Yes, we are about to launch an update to our website that makes all of this data for all countries freely available that you can look at. You can see how nearly 150 countries perform relative to these national donuts from this study. And so that's available to look at. But I think you raise a really, really great point with the question around the social thresholds that we've chosen. And really, it's an international standard, right? Which is useful on the one hand, because then you can compare Hungary to Malawi, to the United States, to whatever. And it's, it's just scientifically for comparability, you need to have a similar threshold, the same threshold, otherwise you can't compare them. But at the same time, that comparison, it really almost like, I think of it like flattening the lived experience of people in any particular place. And the core question, you want to be able to look at this visual, this image, and you ask yourself, like, is that reflecting back my country, my situation? Because that's really what the donut is all about. It's supposed to show, it's a goal-oriented framework that says, where do we want to be? And then compares your current performance to that. And so when you take this, global sample, you lose a lot of that locally relevant context that takes into account, if I'm in Hungary, do my aspirations need to be like such at this, this international standard that you've chosen? I would argue that it wouldn't. It's just a methodological choice here. But of course, if you in Hungary, so take the example of life expectancy. If suddenly life expectancy in Hungary went from, I'm not sure what it is right now, but let's say it's 80 years. if it suddenly went from 80 years to 75 years, and our threshold is 74 years globally, so you'd still be within that threshold. But of course, that would be a social, that would be a disaster in Hungary. So the method wouldn't, it just, the internationally comparable method doesn't capture that. And so I think that it's really important just to say that this study is a first step and is gesturing at specific nations, hopefully so that others can say, wait, what are our local aspirations in Hungary? And how can we redefine them so that it more captures the essence of our place compared to this, you know, this globally international standard. At the same time, the environmental burdens, those are less negotiable. So, you know what I mean? So I can see a strong argument for places wanting to improve their aspirations for social performance. Great, you want to do better. That's fantastic. And of course, much needed, because as I said, the alternative would be a decline in life expectancy or a decline in access to education. And that's just, you know, nobody's arguing for that. That would be absurd. But at the same time, you need to achieve those aspirations while acknowledging your responsibilities for environmental impact, which you can't really, you can't just pick and choose those.
Well, we have touched upon a few solutions on how to close this gap or how to move towards this safe and just space. But Phil, I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question. What do you think is the solution? What policy implications your research might have or should have?
Change everything. No, the reality, at least for me, like nobody knows the answer to that question, like, which I find, honestly, I find it both terrifying on the one hand, but also exhilarating, because we, you know, we can point to what we know. We've inherited this economic system that's not fit for the 21st century context and challenges that we're facing. So what we need to do is invent a new one. And that new one has to have new theories and new policies and new models. And nobody knows what that could look like in practice because it hasn't been invented yet. So we have to, I believe, just try things and see what happens and experiment. And I don't think that there's a single solution, especially given just like the hugely different contexts and histories of places around the world. If we're talking about, you know, Hungary's transformation towards living within the donut and Malawi's transformation towards living within the donut and the United States, those are just massively different experiences and contexts. But what our research really does show, I think, is that richer countries need to dramatically reduce their resource use to avoid, you know, critical planetary degradation, which has overwhelmingly been caused by their historical contributions. While poorer countries need to just rapidly accelerate social performance to meet the needs of their residents. So I think that in wealthy countries with high levels of social achievement, you know, we see like Germany and Norway are often held up as these international role models, or Austria, but they have levels of resource use that need to be massively reduced to get within planetary boundaries. And I don't think that transition, and I think I can speak for ecological economists in general, we don't think that transition is going to be achieved with decoupling of resource use from GDP growth or resource efficiency alone. So wealthy countries need to move beyond the pursuit of economic growth as a national goal. Doesn't make sense anymore, and instead pursue policies that improve human well-being and reduce resource use much more directly. So universalizing access to basic goods and services, distributing income more fairly through maximum income, through resource caps, all that stuff. But at the same time, for low-income countries with high social shortfalls, you know, we need this focus on meeting basic needs. It's required. And with an emphasis, especially, I believe, on capacity building and on sovereign economic development. This gets into just the current economic system, globalized economic system too, is that, you know, our results suggest that neoliberal policies that have been, you know, adopted over the past four decades, they've just failed to deliver meaningful outcomes in the global south. So what the existing global system really does is it seems like it mobilizes Southern resources and labor to serve the interests of foreign investors, when what we really need to do is focus on meeting basic needs directly. So I think countries in the global South, it's like they've just been shackled by post-colonial histories, by debt, by trade and finance rules, and they should have the freedom to build sovereign economic capacity while using their social policies and developing public services to deliver those same universal healthcare, education, housing, good livelihoods, food security, all that stuff. So I'd say, yes, our existing economic system is really using resources to support this elite consumption and almost, you know, massive multinational corporate interests rather than to meet basic needs. And that needs to change.
I quite like George Monbiot's idea of private sufficiency and public luxury, because basically what you were saying and when we look at social indicators, it really does show that we're relying on common community public goods, public wealth, when we're talking about social indicators, like the health system, the educational system, the basic provisioning system, the housing, etc. So I think I think this concept can also be applied to both the global South and the global North, because improving public provisioning and public luxury, as Monbiot says, can be a way forward, maybe.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's essential. I think it's absolutely essential, to be honest, because if we're going to talk about reducing levels of resource use, which, I mean, to be honest, given the current relationships between GDP, like economic activity, and resource use, it doesn't look, based on current relationships at least, look possible to reduce the levels of resource use to the levels that are needed to avoid, you know, climate and ecological breakdown, while still maintaining the levels of economic activity that we have. And so if that's the reality, then you want to call that, I mean, that's not degrowth, but that's a reduction in resource use that will also likely lead to a reduction in economic activity. I don't see a way around that. So the core piece is to make it what we've been talking about. We need to decouple people's livelihoods and people's well-being and people's jobs from resource use and economic activity. Otherwise, how are we going to get there without you know, overshooting, you know, creating potential, you know, breakdown and all that stuff? So I think that it's absolutely essential to universalize those core basic goods and services that everyone needs in order to then be able to, or maybe not then, simultaneously, whatever. But we've seen that when you try to implement from the Yellow Vests movement, which has been the topic of massive research, because it supposedly arose from a climate-related policy, but there wasn't the equity element, and it was hitting those who were, you know, poorest and least equipped, and they rose up. And you can't blame them for that in the current economic system, I believe. So what we need to do is make sure that we take people's livelihoods out of the equation. And the way to do that is by putting them into the public luxury side.
To close out this episode, I'm asking you the question I ask all my guests. What is your rebellion?
What is my rebellion? So my rebellion kind of like personally, or?
Yes, personally.
Okay. So I would say that I'm just rebelling against the notion that the current economic system that we've inherited can continue. It's just, there's absolutely no, my research shows it, multiple people's research shows it, our common sense says it. It's just, it cannot continue. So I refuse to accept that a business as usual can go on. Despite so many, you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a lot of talk at the beginning of how this is an opportunity to really change and the extent that that has actually happened, I haven't seen much, to be honest. So it seems like business as usual has put the shackles around, just put the blinders back on and continued along. And I rebel against that idea. So I guess a small thing that I've done is to stop using the terms developed and developing countries. It's a super tiny thing, but from the perspective of the donut, I really believe that we are all developing countries now. It's one of the first things that Kate Raworth said when she saw one of the charts in our study, in our previous study. She said, wow, what this really shows is we are all developing countries now from the perspective of the donut. So this idea that, you know, Austria, Germany, Norway, US, we are developed, it's just not founded in reality either. But another thing, I guess, to get even more personal in terms of rebellion, it's I've learned from so many climate and ecological activists, really to broaden my understanding of what activism entails, because I thought, you know, kind of activism is like you go out on the street and you get a protest and you stand in a crowd. And I think that it's much bigger than that. And to realize that we need everybody's skills, so that if you're good at rallying a crowd or, you know, screaming or whatever, then great. But if you're good at writing, then that's fine. And if you can contribute to analysis and compelling data visualizations that show the challenge that we're facing, then I think that's great too. And I think that's kind of where I see that I have a contribution to make, maybe most substantively. But I'm also learning to rebel against my own inherited like privilege through living part of this system that we've all been born into, or I'm white passing, at least. I have family who are from the Caribbean, but I pass as white. I'm male, come from middle class. I'm straight. So I think that it's important to acknowledge the privileges that we have been inherited, because they give us benefits. And unless we can say that, hey, I'm just doing, I've received benefits that weren't earned just because of what I look like or how I speak or whatever, then I think that that's something that needs to be talked about and also rebelled against. So yeah, some ideas.
Thank you. So many thanks to you, Andrew, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Andrew. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.